A dull November morning. In Birmingham's Winston Green Jail, two guards take the elbows of a bewildered young man and march him to the gallows. He is the last to be hanged in that place. This isn't ancient history. It's 1962. The young man is Oswald Gray. He's from Jamaica, and he's been in England for just 2 years. Not heard of this before? You're not alone. It's forgotten history. A bungled robbery, a single shot from a stolen pistol, and newsagent Thomas Bates lies dead in his shop in Lee Bank Road. The law rushes to punish Oswald Gray. 6 months do not pass from the crime to the rope. Young, black, and disposable, he is a victim of miscarried justice. His story shouts to us across the decades. Who Killed Oswald Gray is a story that makes sure that neither Oswald nor Thomas will be forgotten. Episode 4. No papers, no fuss, no reprieve.
It is Friday, October 12, 1962, at Birmingham's Law Courts. Judge Sir Gilbert Paul dons the black cap and sentences 20-year-old Jamaican Oswald Gray to death for the murder of Thomas Bates in his shop on Lee Bank Road the previous June. His trial has not lasted 5 full working days. Just over 2 weeks later, his case is taken to appeal. It takes that hearing less than an hour to dismiss his case, the same time that the jury took to find him guilty. But this has not been a secure conviction. There has never been definitive proof that Gray had the gun at the time of the murder. The court knew, in the language of the day, that he was a backward child, easily led. No allowance was made, as it should have been, when condemning him to death. And now we know that the presiding judge harbored a damning prejudice, believing, with no evidence, that Gray was homosexual, an actual crime according to the law in 1962. Why has the state been so keen to dispose of this young black man? Why have they done so with such haste? And why do so few people know about this case, that of the last black man hanged at Winston Green Prison and the last black man hanged in Britain? This is episode 4, Who Killed Oswald Gray? No papers, no fuss, no reprieve.
Hi, I'm Jazzy P with Genesis Radio Birmingham, and I am here with John Berry, the author of Who Killed Oswald Gray. John, I know you've managed to locate a good deal of the paperwork relating to this case, but much of it has also been withheld. Just give an idea of what's going on here.
I'll keep this as brief as I can, because this is a saga that's lasted for 5 years. The top and bottom of it is that most of the trial papers are under an embargo until June 2062. Now, that's after any number of Freedom of Information requests and appeals from me. The justification is that their release will cause harm and anguish to surviving relatives of both the victim and the culprit.
That doesn't seem very likely after 60 years, does it? And after all, however brief the coverage at the time, it was actually in the public domain.
Well, you're right. And I think that something unspoken is in play here.
And what do you think that is?
I made my first request to see all the papers in May 2020, the time of the murder of George Floyd at the hands of a Minneapolis policeman. Now, as we know, in the months that followed, the Black Lives Matter movement swept the world. People's awareness of how judicial systems discriminate against black people became the issue of the day, and authorities became nervous of this level of protest.
And you think that this influenced them in the case of the National Archive on the advice of the Home Office in their decision to withhold these papers?
Almost certainly. Think about the medical report on Oswald Gray that was presented in court. And as they saw it, illiterate, backward Jamaican. Now, just imagine the language of that report and the prejudice it would reveal. I think the authorities looked at my request for the release of the papers, then looked at that report and thought, blimey, we can't let that sort of stuff out in this atmosphere. And if you put that together with some of the stuff that was revealed in the papers I did get about the appeal process, then it's a pretty damning picture.
The last throw of the dice is to appeal to the Home Secretary for leniency, for mercy, to spare this young man's life. There should be hope. One in four such cases results in reprieve. It is often young men acting stupidly and impetuously who benefit from this grace and favour from the Home Secretary. The Home Secretary, the person, until 2007, always the man, who oversaw law and order. Who was this man in 1962?
It was Henry Brooke, Marlborough School in Oxford, later Baron Brooke of Cumnor. He'd only been appointed in July, and within days he'd made his mark. He was asked the following question in the House of Commons.
Has the Home Secretary considered the case of Miss Carmen Bryan, a Jamaican girl of 22 years of age living in this country since 1960, who, having pleaded guilty to a first offence of petty larceny involving goods valued at £2, was conditionally discharged and recommended for deportation by the Paddington Magistrates Court on the 12th of June?
Yes, you heard that right. A Jamaican girl stole £2 worth of goods and is recommended for deportation. The questioner carries on.
She has since been detained in Holloway Prison. The power of deportation under the 1962 Immigrants Act was not intended to apply to cases of petty larceny. Will the Home Secretary refuse to implement the magistrate's recommendation for deportation?
I think we can confidently predict the answer to that, can't we?
We can. He confirmed the recommendation for deportation. Now, as it happens, he bowed to pressure in the next few days and relented. But it's a telling episode.
So, just to recap. First of all, a local magistrate recommends deportation for a £2 theft. Then the Home Secretary supports that recommendation and only relents after significant pressure.
And he didn't do it with any great grace. Here's what he said about his decision.
Deportations will go on. People are not to think that if they commit an offence and are recommended for deportation, that they can count on escaping because of this case. I equally warn people that if they want to return to their own country, they'd better not imagine that the better way is to go stealing in shops and rely on that to get home at the taxpayers' expense.
And this is the man who, 3 months later, is charged with the final say. Life or death for Oswald Augustus Gray.
We've already heard that the judge, Sir Gilbert Paul, expressed in the view in the appeal papers that there may have been a gay relationship between Mover, Harris Carniff, and Oswald. An idea that seemed to exist entirely in his own imagination, don't you think?
Yeah. Completely and utterly bizarre.
And there's more really astonishing stuff, isn't there?
Really astonishing. As part of the reprieve process, a civil servant, senior civil servant, Charles Cunningham, speaks to Paul and reports back to his boss, the Home Secretary Henry Brooke. This is what Cunningham writes.
Sir Gilbert had formed the impression that the whole truth had not come out.
Wait, this is from an official Home Office briefing. The whole truth has not come out then?
Yep. You heard that right. So here's what the rest of the report said.
There was no doubt that Carniff was a bad and dangerous character, and he was most probably the influence behind a great deal of crime. Gray had said repeatedly that it was Carniff who told him to steal the pistol. Paul thought it possible that Gray, who appeared to him to be homosexual, was acting under Carniff's influence. Carniff wanted to have a demonstration that he was capable of armed robbery before admitting him to a gang. The judge also thought it possible that Gray had been trying to shield Carniff.
I'm still trying to get my head round this properly. These are comments from the presiding judge who had sentenced this boy to death. This is what he admitted to thinking.
And that's not the end of it. Remember the Homicide Act? Remember how keen the legislature was to follow parts of it? Death for armed robbery, whatever, but ignore others, taking into account mental incapacity? Here's another extract from the report of Paul's comment to the Home Office.
Paul said that if he had tried the case before the coming into operation of the Homicide Act, he was clear that he would have written to the Home Secretary, pointing out that he thought it possible that Gray, who was a young man, had acted under the influence of others, and he would have recommended a reprieve.
But he didn't do that?
No, he didn't do that. And so, on Friday, 16th November, Home Secretary Henry Brooke, the man who would deport a Jamaican woman for shoplifting, signs the death warrant for Oswell Augustus Gray in his neat handwriting. The law, he wrote, must take its course. On the following Tuesday morning, the execution took place. And was there protests about this judicial killing with a racial edge? Was there uproar in the prison? Did it splash across the front of the Birmingham Post? It did not. Tucked in the inside page, a brief passage told of the hanging and of how.
Uniformed and plainclothed police stood on duty outside the prison gates as four students from Birmingham University paraded with anti-capital punishment placards.
Four students. And inside the prison? In 1989, playwright Peter Wynne Wilson interviewed prison officer Tony Montford, who had been on duty guarding Oswell Gray. Here are his words, transcribed from the worn tapes.
There was very little outcry or fuss in the rest of the prison. I think there were some students outside or something, and I was told that three coloured people refused to eat their breakfast, left it outside the cells. I only heard tell of about the students outside, but I didn't see any of that. Throughout the whole thing, there was nothing unusual, nothing extreme. What you've got to remember is the majority of prisoners are in favour of hanging. They still are. That they've got wives, sweethearts, family outside, and they want them protected. And I'm in favour too, like most prison officers. Your life is the most precious thing you have. And every day you pick up the paper and hear about people being beaten up and killed, pensioners being knocked down and killed for 2 or 3 quid of their pension money. If you do that, you should forfeit your life too.
There was no fuss. There was no outcry. There were no protests. That begins to explain why this is forgotten history. Why someone like me, who has lived in Lee Bank my whole adult life, nearly 45 years, had never heard of this. How do we explain this low-key reaction? Why has this been forgotten?
I'm Paul Ferguson, and my dad came here from Jamaica in 1961. I think in those times, just about when my dad got here, they just wanted to get here, get established, and get in without too much of a fuss. My dad, like most people, had an established trade. They were mainly skilled people who came. My dad was a baker, but the only job he could get himself was cleaning buses. But still, people thought, this is the mother country. Don't raise your head above the parapet. We just want a peaceful life. We just want to get on. Just blend in and embrace as much as you can. Don't argue with them because they're probably right. If something like that had happened around 1981, around the time I left school, you'd have had riots. You'd have had Handsworth. You'd have had Chapeltown. You'd have had Toxteth, Bristol-type riots. If that had happened in the noughties, or like Mark Duggan in 2011, you'd have had the same. And if that had happened 4 or 5 years ago, with the advent of social media, well, you all saw what happened with George Floyd, you'd probably have hashtag Roy Gray. 20 years after the event, when I was growing up, we'd had Handsworth Revolution and everything that went with it, and we just weren't going to stand for it.
Timid? Afraid of the fuss? Don't get noticed? And that must have suited those in power and influenced at the time. Let's listen to prison officer Tony Muntford again. Shall we cut him some slack? Speaking 35 years ago?
At that time, the black population in prison was very small. But they were much more grown up and mature. That first lot that come over from Jamaica and elsewhere, they were a lot more sensible. They knew that if you'd stepped out of line, you just had to do your time and get on with it. There wasn't colour prejudice in the prison like there is now. This younger generation, you see, they brought it with them. They got a chip on their shoulder and they think the world owes them a living sort of thing.
Well, perhaps we won't cut him that slack. At every level, from the police station to the condemned cell, from copper to judge, from Winston Green to the Home Office, the odds were always stacked against a wayward Jamaican boy, easily led and then hastily disposed of. In episode 5 of Who Killed Oswald Gray, we'll be asking more questions. What happened to Oswald's mortal remains? And what of the fate of the rest of his family? I am Sue Brown, and you can listen to all episodes on Genesis Radio Birmingham.
You have been listening to episode 4 of Who Killed Oswald Gray? No papers, no fuss, no reprieve. You have heard the voices of Sue Brown, Jazzy P, Peter Wynn Wilson, Paul Ferguson, and the writer John Berry. Original music is written and performed by Anthony Williams and Sue Brown. Other music is supplied by Bloodline Music. The producer is Paul Toll, and I am Chicken George, executive editor. This has been a GCRB presentation.
Who Killed Oswald Gray is a Genesis Radio production, all rights reserved. For permission to use any part of this broadcast, contact the author John Berry at www.johnberrywriter.co.uk.